Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition for March 19th, 2015 on WPFW Washington 89.3, your station for jazz and justice here in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam, your producer and host for this show all about activists and activism. Today, economist and author Julianne Malvo talks about the plight of D.C. home care workers and this month's installment of The F-Word with the author, activist, and educator Sam Anderson. We have a lot for you packed into the show, starting with our headlines and happenings. This morning, actually beginning in about 30 minutes, activists with popular resistance will meet on the lower level of Union Station here in D.C. to plan an action today on Capitol Hill opposing the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP. The activists say that hundreds of the world's largest multinational corporations like Monsanto, Goldman Sachs, Pfizer, BP, and Exxon are doing everything they can to protect and grow their profits under the facade of free trade. For the last 6 years, these corporations have crafted secret deals with President Obama's full support, and they are now trying to push these through Congress with a clearly anti-democratic process known as Fast Track. The public and even Congress do not have access to the full text of the documents for these secret trade deals, and Fast Track would slip them into law under the radar. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich is featured in this clip explaining the TPP.
Republicans in Congress are eager to work with the Obama administration to fast-track the passage of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. If you haven't heard much about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that's part of the problem right there. It would be the largest trade deal in history, involving countries stretching from Chile to Japan, representing 792 million people and accounting for 40% of the world economy. Yet it's been devised in secret. Lobbyists from America's biggest corporations and Wall Street's biggest banks have been involved, but not the American public. The pharmaceutical industry, for example, they get stronger patents, delaying cheaper generic versions of drugs. Big corporations and Wall Street get an international tribunal of private attorneys outside any nation's legal system that can order compensation for any lost profits found to result from a nation's regulations. That means even U.S.-based corporations could challenge any U.S. government regulation they claim unfairly diminishes their profits. Say, laws that protect American consumers from unsafe products or unhealthy foods, that protect workers, block toxic emissions, or prevent another taxpayer-funded bailout of Wall Street. The Obama administration says the trade deal will boost U.S. exports. But the deal will also allow American corporations to outsource even more jobs abroad. In other words, it's a Trojan horse in a global race to the bottom, giving big corporations from Wall Street banks a way to eliminate laws and regulations that get in the way of their profits. Right now, they're trying to get something called fast-track authority, so this massive giveaway can pass without any public review or power to amend. So we have to say loud and clear, no to fast-track and no to the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
That was former Labor Secretary Robert Reich talking about the secretive Trans-Pacific Partnership, also known as the TPP. You actually still have time to join in today's action by emailing mckenzie@popularresistance.org. That's M-A-C-K-E-N-Z-I-E @popularresistance.org. They're meeting on the lower level of Union Station to plan their action. Also today through Saturday, March 21st, the first global conference on defending Dalit rights is underway on the campus of Trinity Washington University in Northeast Washington, D.C. That's off of North Capitol Street. The purpose of the global conference is to increase awareness of the injustices visited upon an estimated 260 million caste-affected individuals worldwide who face caste-based discrimination, exclusion, inequality, and violence. Their plight is a modern humanitarian crisis, even referred to by some as the apartheid of this millennium. Though historically this injustice has gone on for thousands of years, every day Dalits are forced into slave and bonded labor, denied access to communal water resources, and refused service at public establishments solely on the basis of their caste or descent. Dalit women and girls are themselves victims of rape and murder, with countless numbers forced into sex trafficking. As part of the Global Conference Organizing Committee will present a human chain demo for Dalit solidarity and dignity on Saturday, March 21st, in front of the White House. And for more information on the conference, please visit icdrintl.org. That's icdrintl.org. You can also call 202-276-3099. That's 202-276-3099. And while those defending Dalit rights are at the White House on Saturday, they will certainly merge with the crowds expected to gather as part of Spring Rising, an anti-war mobilization beginning at noon in front of the White House, not only to commemorate the 12th anniversary of the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq that some estimates find brought the deaths of more than a million Iraqis, but also to demand a halt to U.S. bombing and drone attacks everywhere and total withdrawal of U.S. forces, covert as well as overt, from the Middle East and Afghanistan. The rally and march will be the culmination of Spring Rising, which started yesterday afternoon with a meet and greet and an evening of music at Plymouth Congregational Church. And tomorrow there will be lobbying on Capitol Hill organized by Code Pink, a bus tour of workplaces in Washington of war planners and profiteers organized by Cindy Sheehan, and at least six teach-ins that will include learning about the relationship of U.S. military activity to climate change, as well as to the militarization of U.S. policy and the military's lack of accountability. And finally, last night, U.S. Secretary of Labor Tom Perez, economist Julianne Malveau, the Reverend Graylin Hagler, and others, elected officials, met with D.C. home care workers in a town hall meeting at Plymouth Congregational Church. The town hall was designed to support D.C. home care workers in their fight to secure unpaid wages and benefits and join the National Fight for 15 movement. The economist Julianne Malveau was the charismatic moderator of the evening, and she charmed the audience with her stories of her own elderly mother and the need for quality care.
I want to tell you a couple of things about me, or not really about me. My mom is a gerontologist, and I've written for years about low-wage workers. And my mom is one of these sisters who isn't proud of her children no matter what we've done. She always wants us a little bit more. When I was a kid and got A minuses, she would say, "Where's the A?" If it was 94, she'd say, "But the 6 points missing." And so when she has an agenda, she will sometimes play a game. So I've written a piece about why home health workers needed more money. And Protean Malveau said to me, she actually did a couple things. First, she introduced me to some man who wore white socks. I'm single, happily and proudly so. is difficult. It's difficult to be over 50 and fine and single. But I worked it out. But my mom still hasn't given up on looking for somebody. So she found this white socks wearing brother, and who dates somebody who wears white socks? So I said, Mom, you have a problem. I said, you have such a problem, I'm going to put you in an old folks home. Now my mom is 86, and she's worse than me. A few people here know me. I'm a pistol. My mom is worse than me. So she said, you can't put me in an old folks home, neck rolling. And I said, I said, keep it up. Send me one more white socks wearing brother, and we will have a place for you. And so then she tried to pander with me, and she said, well, Juliana, if you put me in an old folks home, help me out. I said, how's that? She said, don't put me in one where the people wear make the minimum wage. And I said, why would that be? She said, well, if you made the minimum wage, what would you be? I said, mad. She said, well, do you want mad people moving me from the bedroom to the bed? And her line was, you know, people need to be paid properly, and she still talks about people being paid properly. People who are not paid properly are not happy people. I don't think that anybody would deliberately drop anybody on the way from the bedpan to the bed. But I do think that somebody might have a little bit of an attitude. What we know right now is that in the district, minimum wage is $13.25. It basically adds up to about 530 cents a week. No, $530, forgive me, a week. If you made $15, it will be $600 a week. So here's the question. What would you do with the extra $70 a week? I'll tell you what you might do. You might buy some shoes for your child. You might buy a few more groceries. You might do something different with your transportation. You might move out to mama's house. And a lot of grown people live in a mama's house. And let me tell you, Froyan didn't have that. She put you up out of your house, her house, and you could sleep in the yard if you stayed in her house too long. But some folks don't have options. So you might, with the extra $70 a week, $280 a month, you might move somewhere else. We've just learned that the number of apartments here in D.C. that go for $800 have dropped. And so we know that people are having a very difficult time. You might look at tutoring for your child after school. And so many of our young people do not have the support they need. You might get your hoopty or your pizza car fixed. You know, I've got a brother, he always has a pizza car. You know, he never had a whole car. You know, he buys a car and he has pieces. And he takes the pieces and hooks them up. And I go ride with him. I love him, but I go ride with him. I go to San Francisco, and he's like, you want me to pick you up? I'm like, nah. I'll meet you somewhere. But a lot of folks don't have an option but to have a pizza car. So you might fix your pizza car. I think the thing that we want to talk about this evening is what would this increase, this very fair increase, mean to the quality of your life? How could you change your life if you were fairly paid? And what does it take to be fairly paid? You're taking care of our elders. We say that our elders are sacred. So then why don't the people who take care of our elders be treated as if our elders are sacred? We pay parking lot attendants more than we pay the people who take care of our elders. Frankly, that does not make any sense. It doesn't make any sense at all. So one of the things that we're doing this evening as we bring you together is motivating you or asking you to come together in an organized way. Motivating you and asking you to barrage the council. with your demands, not requests, but demands. Because Frederick Douglass said power concedes nothing without a struggle. It never did and it never will. Those who want freedom without agitation are those who want the ocean without its mighty roar. I want y'all to roar, 1199. I want y'all to raise your voices and to scream out for social and economic justice. If you were taking care of my mom, I don't want you to drop her on the way from the bedpan to bed, although she might aggravate you enough to do that. I threaten her just about once a week. So I pray, if you don't stop. But she is a gerontologist, and she often says, these people need to be paid more.
That was economist Julianne Malvo speaking last night at a town hall meeting for D.C. home care workers. For more information about the campaign, go to WeCareForDC.org. That's WeCareForDC.org. When we come back, more conversation about the F word, the convergence of increased corporate control of the state through rulings such as Citizens United, combined with a culture of violence and impunity for the military and law enforcement, only reinforces, for some of us on the left anyway, that there is what we commonly refer to as creeping fascism. Stay with us.
Who's watching me?
And welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Averam, and our next segment is our monthly segment called The F Word, which explores fascism, what it is, what it is not, and its elements. And this month, we are talking again to Sam Anderson, author, activist, and educator, and whose most recent book is The Black Holocaust for Beginners. Welcome back, Sam.
Thank you.
So last time we talked, we covered a lot of ground in our conversation with you and your wife, Rosemary Milley, who was also an author, activist, and educator. And when we stopped, we were talking about Rudy Giuliani, actually, and his total defense of police brutality and police abuses in New York during his tenure as mayor. And I have to say, as I continue to do these segments, I've kind of, after talking to you, Rosemary, and also Gerald Horn, I understand that what we're really talking about are the ways that we're living in the elements of a pre-fascist society, right?
Right.
So it's evolved to that point, this segment. And as we talk about a pre-fascist society, it occurs to me that, well, we're talking about these various elements of it. The brutality, the impunity of the police and military, and we're also talking about the economic elements of it, but also the people. So when we talk about somebody like Rudy Giuliani, what we're talking about is how the way he defends the police, the way he kind of serves police power and lifts that up is very dangerous Yeah, so I guess I'm trying to figure out how we discuss these things and how we sound the alarm in a sense so that people in the larger community and society understand that these are really dangerous trends.
Yes, they are absolutely dangerous. And the other component in that is the advancement in technology that, in how would you say, invades one's privacy.
Mm-hmm.
In New York City, and I'm sure in the D.C. area and most urban areas in the United States, if one leaves home to go to work or to go to school, they will most likely encounter a minimum of seven cameras, either through a bodega or deli, or through an ATM machine, or through a camera mounted on the street, or through a camera within, or a series of cameras within public transportation, either on a bus or on a subway. And all that data is fed into a central system that the Giuliani types rule over.
Right, right.
So that's another component that we, you know, need to understand exists.
You know, and as you mentioned that, it reminds me of how I think so many people from different strata of society, different segments of society, really understood what the significance of the Edward Snowden revelations, because whether mm-hmm. you are, you know, for whatever reason, most Americans, you know, we value our sense of privacy. We want to feel like, you know, we don't have those seven cameras, and that, you know, we, when we talk on the phone, someone isn't listening or someone isn't privy to our email.
Right.
And
right.
And then of course there are those of us who, you know, had some level of education, you know, we automatically think about 1984. You
right.
know,
right.
we think
yeah.
about Big Brother, and his revelations really made us feel like we were getting closer and closer to that type of totalitarianism, and
right.
and it was happening right underneath our nose, and we didn't know
yeah.
about it.
Right, you're absolutely right on that. You know, and people are mesmerized by the advancement of technology, and not realizing that it was a deal with the capitalist devil in that. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And actually, when you started talking about the capitalist devil, that reminds me that it's actually become this undoing of some of the strongest sector of the American economy, because these mega corporations like Facebook and Google, what they're finding is that they're being undermined overseas, because people in Europe and even, you know, they don't want to, you know, work with these corporations. They don't want to be a part of these platforms if they know that basically there's this backdoor for the NSA or whatever European entity is
right.
similar for them to go in and basically collect people's data.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
You're right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about, you know, since we had that last discussion, a few things happened. The Department of Justice put out this report talking about the really horrific conditions that black people are living under in St. Louis County in communities like Ferguson. And secondly, the Republicans just put out a new budget that continues to try to hack away at basic safety net issues for poor and working people and middle class people, and put more and more of the economy, of our basically our public tax wealth, into the
right.
hands of private corporations and the wealthy. And then thirdly, we could add the re-election of Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, and kind of tie those things together. So what do you say about that DOJ report?
The present attorney general's legacy, okay, positive legacy that he will leave behind, and that is to say that he was the black conscience of Obama. opportunity to really drill down into the structural racism of, like you said, St. Louis County and particularly Ferguson, was a way of exposing the institutionalized racism across the nation in terms of police and their racist attitude towards black folk across the country. And I think we need to look at that report, that DOJ report, from that context. And even though they may not have, under the present legal constraints, they may not have the ability to indict and imprison the mayor, the city manager, and the head of the police, et cetera, et cetera. When people read that document, they see the fundamental criminal nature of the structure, not the individuals, but the structure to ill-gotten gain money off of the criminalizing of black people. I think that's the one of the most important things that will come out of that justice report.
You know, what you said just now about structure is really important, because even in this most recent big news story about the fraternity in Oklahoma that, you know, had this racist rant on the bus, the coverage, yes, mm-hmm. of race, so much goes back to the individual and this kind of emotional coverage about words. And
right.
and not so much about the, you know, and that becomes what racism is, as opposed to the actual economic destruction, physical right. destruction of people, which is certainly really what is the racism that really is harming us. You know, like your mother will say, you know, sticks and stones may break your bones, but
right.
names will never hurt you. Sure, you don't want your child exposed to something like that, but that isn't what's going to hurt him or her, right? It's going to be a lack of opportunity, someone basically shutting your life down at 18 or 19 over a phony arrest or,
right.
you know, a ticket that keeps you from getting a job.
Yes.
Or an arrest that, you know, breaks up your family and throw, you know, make just destroys your life. So,
or the continuous fining aspect that drains your meager income.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you know, kind of structure versus kind of like words and the outer. You know, these outer things that don't really get to the heart of what is oppressing you in a way. I don't want to minimize mental oppression and the types of societal things that people are put on people, like, you know, just on a daily basis that are social.
Right.
I know those things are important, but sometimes those aren't the things that will keep you from like living and making a living.
That's right.
You know.
Right.
So how about moving on to the next thing? I guess this Republican budget is really just an outgrowth of this last election cycle. I guess we knew it was coming. They have
yes.
a majority in the Senate now. They have a majority in the House. And so this
right.
House budget is, I suppose it's, you know, I've heard some people just call it just ridiculous. It's just theater. And it really shouldn't even be commented on because it's not going to get passed. It's not going to go anywhere. But it's just the idea that people want to use government as theater to score political points as opposed to kind of moving society forward and, you know, being stewards of the public good. You know, that's kind of like a joke here in the deep. I guess
yes, it is a joke now. I think that the folk who are overseeing the Republican Party are a little more sophisticated than the individuals within the Tea Party madness within the Republican Party, and that they understand that the Democratic Party is only slightly to the left, about a millimeter, to the Republican Party, and that when they allow their right, super right-wing forces to throw out all of these ridiculous, oftentimes proto-fascist set of policies and racist policies, that the Democratic Party will not attack them face on, and that they will come up with, like a knee-jerk reaction, they'll come up with some sort of compromise, and that compromise is really what the sophisticated right-wing forces want, not what the people want. And so this, like you said, this theater that's happening in within the within Congress is just that, but it is also helping to legitimize a more right-wing policy setup.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition devoted to activists and activism on WPFW Washington 89.3, your station for jazz and justice. I'm Esther Averam, and I'm talking to the author, activist, and educator Sam Anderson, and we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to finish our discussion. Stay with us.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month.
Most of those bombs, not every one of them, but most of them, are bombs that, according to international law, are considered war crimes. Anti-personnel bombs, napalm, white phosphorus, Agent Orange, all of the things that are dropping from the bellies of our airplanes made in this country are considered war crimes.
You just heard Jane Fonda, American actress and anti-Vietnam War activist, reacting to her show being canceled at Travis Air Force Base in 1971. Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982, funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at pacificaradioarchives.org. Thanks for keeping our women's history alive.
Treat me Rasta man, like them no know say that man a real African. You think me no member King Ferdinand, and thief in Columbus have a golden plan. Them make a wrong turn and end up in Caribbean. One Rasta genocide kill enough Indian. Them turn paradise in a plantation and bring cross one ship load of African. Now here comes the thief in Queen from England. Now she come well and envy maga. A century full of separation, and after 400 years, me send a reparation. I know them want to kill me with the taxation, but I beg you, please take me to the motherland. I beg you, carry me go home. I bring me from the east.
And welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Averam. We are talking again to Sam Anderson, author, activist, and educator, and whose most recent book is The Black Holocaust for Beginners. When I have these discussions with people, there's a discussion of the corporate state, and people like Hillary Clinton, like Barack Obama, like George Bush and his dad, you know, that right. They all serve that corporate state using a different faces.
Right.
And so when we start talking about pre-fascism, What do you think is the difference between what people refer to as corporatism or living in a corporate state and living under like pre-fascism, or is it the same thing?
I think it's, on one level, maybe some semantics. On another level, it can be a nuanced question. A corporate state could be just another phrase for a fascist state. Because we know that with fascism, it is the economic class, the one percenters that dominate in terms of the political and the political structure, the executive branch and the legislative branch of the government. And they also have, because of how they evolved, they have direct control over the military. So for some groups, some left groups and progressive groups, corporate state equals fascism. we're not there. My position is that we're not there yet. And people say, well, why? And I say, well, because Sister Esther and I are talking on the internet. You know, if we were there, we would have this conversation just between you and I. If we had it, you know, nobody else would be listening in because of how full blown fascism will shut down every aspect of democracy, every aspect of what is so revered in this country, quote unquote, free speech.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm really interested in how a lot of these ideas on the black left developed during the 60s, how this analysis developed during the black power movement. I'm wondering if was there a split between activists who were, I guess, more nationalists, who only view the struggle in terms of race, and right. and those who looked at it in terms of economics, you know, and I'm also curious about whether there was any unity, more unity than people think, around the whole idea of Pan-Africanism, because a lot of the African leaders, they were African, they were black, and they were very much nationalist in terms of their race pride and understanding about being African, but they also had a sophisticated analysis in terms of economics.
Yeah.
So and so to be Pan-African was often to be a nationalist, but also to be socialist, to have a different type of collective or anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist viewpoint.
Yes, that's a good question. And it was during that period of the 60s and 70s, it was evolving, it was complex, and it was evolving. The precursor to the Black Panther Party was the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, which was located in Lowndes County, Alabama. And that's where the creation of the symbol of the Black Panther Party came about in 1965, which resulted, that whole development resulted from how the Democratic Party shafted the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. They promised them a seat at the 1964 Democratic Party convention and then reneged on it, to make a long story short. And the SNCC forces, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee forces, felt really shafted by the Democratic Party. And they began to listen in those months after August in 64, began to listen to what Brother Malcolm was saying and what other black nationalists were saying, and saying in terms of self-determination, in terms of the hypocrisy of white folks. And one of two results came out of that listening over those few months was the creation of the Lowndes County Freedom Organization that would organize an independent black political party in a county where it was 80% black folk. And there was resistance against that by the more integrationist forces within SNCC. But stuff was happening very rapidly, and that the more radical forces were able to dominate and began to organize in Lowndes County, in Alabama, and in Mississippi, against registering people to vote for the Democratic Party, but to vote for something that was go for self. Simultaneously, the young black folk within the SNCC were also heeding what Malcolm had stated in 63 and 64 in that period was the opposition to the war in Vietnam, and they started a campaign against the draft, and the campaign, along with what Muhammad Ali did in that very same period of resisting the draft, the campaign was based on "No Vietnamese ever called me a nigger," and our fight is here in the United States. I'm not going to go to a country where the people are fighting for their freedom. That all of that was wrapped up in that movement and developing into a formidable force within the quote-unquote civil rights movement. And in the spring, summer of 1965, the fall of 65, and then the spring of 1966, so that we have a force of young black people raising the issue of not only self-determination, but also being critical of the capitalist system, with an understanding of that. Of that system, and that the discussion shifted within the SNCC forces from integration to one of black political power. And then in the late spring of 1966, it shifted even further or more generalized to the issue of black power. And with black power, it resonated among young black people all across this country, resulting in all forms of black consciousness and political consciousness groups popping up everywhere. And so when we put a broad overview of this, we see that the dominant trend was one, like you said earlier, of being a black nationalist, but also one of understanding the class differences that existed not only within America but within black America. And so that is the kernel in which we see all of these other developments rapidly coming out of that period of 1966. The Gary Convention, the Congress of African People, the movement of black people against apartheid, all of that, the African Liberation Support Committee in 1972, all of that comes out of that whole complex experience, along with the rise of black cultural consciousness. You know, the power of that movement forced a young brother who always wore his hair in a fried manner, always had his hair processed. That was James Brown coming out and saying, "I'm black and I'm proud," and not having a process anymore, but having an afro. That was a major, major, major shift in across the country. So it was a very powerful, very critical, very pivotal moment. I'm talking about is the rise of black consciousness, black political consciousness, black cultural consciousness, from 1965 to about 1967.
Okay. And you know, some of those same, I don't know if you want to call them splits or not, but some of those same differences in approach are still happening in today in the Black Lives Matter movement. Yeah. I've kind of watched some of it with concern, actually, because there are people who, because of the nature of the attack and being attacked by the police, which is predominantly a white force, you know, people want to, there are a lot of people who just want to look at it in terms of race and seem to look with suspicion on anybody who wants to look at it in a larger systemic way in terms of capitalism, in terms of the prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex, and this is larger than race. I know also in my lifetime, you know, having seen, I'm being more of a post-civil rights, post-black power generation in a sense, I've seen how you have black people who are also imperialists, who are also oppressors, you know, you have watching all the neo-colonial, you know, puppets in Africa and in other parts of the diaspora. You know, these people are black people. You know, somebody was telling me recently about all the billionaires in Nigeria. And I said, well, that has to be all ill-gotten gains. You know, there shouldn't be any billionaires in a country that racked by poverty and poor education and other issues. So that's one thing that I see happening right now. And I'm kind of participating in some of it in discussions, but also watching it and observing it as a journalist. But this era we're talking about obviously is so huge. You know, the last time we talked, you had a really good list of things. You said, you know, you talked about culture, education, all these spheres of life that are obviously touched by this kind of corporate control of the state.
The right-wing forces are, I'm talking about the ruling part of it, is allowing the Tea Party forces to push these absurd things, knowing full well that the Democratic Party leadership has been so compromised since 2001 that the realistic or real politic right-wing agenda is moving forward within the Democratic Party framework. And that's what we're facing at this point in March and April of 2015. And it's going to be a precursor to what the Democratic Party wants to happen, is that a Hillary Clinton and all of the people that surround her running for Congress and so forth will be moving forward. And that agenda is the continuation of the Reagan agenda, the right-wing conservative agenda that allows the one percenters to have a minimum amount of taxing, allows the one percenters to steamroll public education in the form of privatization, charter schools, testing, and so forth and so on. Housing the same way in the major urban centers and what have you. So that people need to understand that the Tea Party forces within the Republican Party is a smoke and mirrors game, and that the conservative forces have under their wing, so to speak, the Democratic Party leadership as well as the Republican Party leadership. And they play one against the other, resulting in the national political scene a major shift further to the right than what we have seen since the Reagan era. The shift has been moving to the right more and more, and the more one nation moves to the right, the more one nation lays the groundwork for fascism.
We're gonna have to wrap up, and I don't know if there's some way that you may want to just kind of talk about what is the most important thing that we need to be thinking about right now when we talk about living in a pre-fascist state. Right. I think you were starting to get to it last time. You were going to talk, zero in on education, and I'm not sure if that's it. But maybe that's one. Maybe we can just figure out one way to kind of wrap up with what is the most important thing that we need to be thinking about and watching for.
Right, and being very brief about it, I think the education component, the public education component, is key. The parental involvement, the student involvement in that all across this country, because the privateers want to disenfranchise us, want us not to be educated but to be schooled, to be programmed for their menial jobs and or prison. I think the other component in this, when we were talking about the evolution of the fight back or the resistance by those who rule, is that COINTELPRO still is alive and thriving today. The counterintelligence program, it has morphed into a program that is very, very significantly part of the thwarting of the Black Liberation Movement. Yeah, there are still undercover agents. We are still under surveillance, and surveillance is much more sophisticated. You know, we need to know that, and we need to understand how to resist. During the Vietnam War period, the slogan was, "The spirit of the people is greater than the man's technology." And I think that kind of slogan you know, we have to take that into serious consideration if those of us who want to fight against the system to understand the connection between the surveillance, the sophisticated surveillance technology, information gathering technology, or as they call it, data mining, and compared to what we have as folk on the ground trying to organize and develop a revolutionary alternative to what's out here. Our young folk need to understand that we have to build a counterintelligence infrastructure that is able to neutralize the sophisticated level of intelligence that those who rule have.
Okay. Well, this is Esther Avaram, and I've been speaking with Sam Anderson, author, activist, and educator, who is author of The Black Holocaust for Beginners. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you. You know.
And actually, if someone wants to reach you, how can they reach you?
Simply by going to blackeducator@mac.com, M-A-C.com.
Okay. All right. And you have a website, don't you?
Yeah, it's blackeducator.org.
Okay, great. So blackeducator.org and is the website, and you can reach
out to Facebook. And Facebook is Black Educator. It's real simple, you know, to get in touch with me.
Okay, great. So thank you so much. We'll have to continue our discussions in the future. Certainly this year, starting in January, many of the activists I was talking to here in D.C., part of the umbrella group of like D.C. Ferguson and Think More and various organizations call this the year of activism. And so
right.
I think it's
I also hope that we'll have, we meaning the Black Progressive Forces, will have a presence at the Left Forum that will take place in New York at John Jay, and I believe it's in June. The Left Forum is very important to come to and network.
Okay.
And, you know, we will be there.
Well, thank you, and we'll make sure that we're there as well, and to bring back to D.C. news and information from the Left Forum.
Okay, great.
Okay. All right. Talk to you again.
All right. Bye-bye.
And that will do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Avaram, your host and producer. A special thanks to my guests, author, activist, and educator Sam Anderson, for joining me today. And thanks to our engineer, Mike Nasella. And thank you so much for listening. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and our past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages. We'd love to hear from you. You can write us at On the Ground Show. Till next week, raise your voice. Peace. I'm gonna go get some more.